The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Deborah Love for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Harvard Health Letter. Our first article is about a new Alzheimer's blood test and what it means for diagnosis. The ability to diagnose Alzheimer's disease simply and cost-effectively took a major step forward in May 2025 when the FDA approved the first blood test for early detection of the condition. It's intended for people ages 55 or older with signs or symptoms of the disease. The test, called LumaPulse, isn't the only one of its kind to look for Alzheimer's blood markers, but it's the only one that has made it through the challenging regulatory approval process, a milestone that's considered a game changer. To find out about the significance of this development and what this could mean for Alzheimer's disease, we turn to Dr. Andrew Budson, lecturer in neurology at Harvard Medical School and chief of cognitive and behavioral neurology at VA Boston Healthcare System. So the first question posed to Dr. Budson, why is LumaPulse being watched so closely when doctors can already detect other similar blood tests for patients? Dr. Budson replies, a number of accurate Alzheimer's blood tests are available for clinical use, and some blood tests have been marketed directly to consumers. But without FDA approval, FDA safety regulation, and public and private insurance coverage, the tests have not been part of the standard of care for diagnosis. They've just been novel tests that people can pay for out of their own pocket. For example, testing might cost between $300 and $1,750 at some companies. Financial assistance is sometimes available. Instead, we've relied on two other more complicated, invasive, and costly types of FDA-approved tests that are covered by insurance to confirm the presence of Alzheimer's. Those are a positron emission tomography, or PET scan of the brain, and a lumbar puncture, or spinal tap, which can detect disease biomarkers in a sample of fluid surrounding the brain and spinal cord. So, question, how does the FDA approval of LumaPulse change things? Dr. Budson replies, the approval means that the blood test has been evaluated by scientists, is doing what it claims, and has the potential to be beneficial in people's care. The next step is for insurance to consider covering it, particularly Medicare and Medicaid. If that happens, which is expected soon, the test will likely become the standard of care and will have a pathway for the rapid detection of Alzheimer's, which will allow us to start treatment immediately. So, question, how does LumaPulse work? Dr. Budson replies, the test analyzes a blood sample to look for several proteins that are characteristic of Alzheimer's disease. It calculates the ratio of amyloid beta 40, which is naturally present in the brain and considered normal, and compares it to the amyloid beta 42, which is involved in forming Alzheimer's brain plaques. The test also looks for a type of tau protein, phosphorylated tau-217, that causes tangles in the brain cells. About 80% of the time, the blood test is either highly positive or highly negative, a result that's accurate more than 90% of the time. About 20% of the time, the test is inconclusive. So, question, how might you and other physicians use LumaPulse if it's covered by insurance? Here's the scenario I envision, he replies. The primary care provider identifies a patient with memory complaints and cognitive impairment as determined by a sensitive but brief cognitive screening test. The patient has blood tests to look for vitamin deficiencies and thyroid disorders, and an MRI scan to look for brain tumors, fluid collections, and other structural problems. If the blood tests and the MRI do not provide answers, the doctor then orders the approved blood test to look for Alzheimer's markers. Question: in that scenario, how are the blood test results used? Reply: if the blood test is clearly negative, the patient is told the reassuring news, but also told that their memory problems will be readdressed in 6 months. If something is still clearly wrong, the patient is referred to a memory specialist to look for other causes of dementia. If the test is inconclusive, the patient is referred to a memory specialist for either an amyloid PET scan or a lumbar puncture to determine the correct diagnosis. If the blood test comes back positive, the patient is referred to a neurologist or another specialist for treatment with amyloid-targeting therapy. Donanemab, known as Kisunla, or lecanemab, known as Leqembi. These medicines remove amyloid plaques from the brain, hopefully before too much damage is done. It's not a cure, but it slows the disease process. And studies show that the earlier you intervene with treatment for someone with symptomatic Alzheimer's in early stages, the more effective the medications will be. And finally, we asked Dr. Budson, do you anticipate that other blood tests for Alzheimer's will be approved? Yes, I expect several other tests will quickly gain FDA approval. Because we have disease-modifying treatments for Alzheimer's disease, there is now an imperative to detect and treat our patients quickly. Just like in a patient in whom cancer is detected, the treatment doesn't need to be initiated in a week, but 6 months is too long, and treatments would ideally begin within 2 months. Blood-based biomarkers will be crucial to help make this scenario into a reality. The next article in this month's Harvard Health Newsletter asks, who's on your diabetes healthcare team? A diabetes diagnosis signals that your body is no longer making or properly using insulin. That's the hormone that gets blood sugar, glucose derived from foods you eat, into your cells to use as energy. If sugar can't get into your cells, sugar levels build up in the blood. Coping with this chronic condition requires a lifelong commitment to control blood sugar and avoid diabetes complications. You'll likely need more than one expert to assist you. Diabetes care has a lot of moving parts, such as medications, blood sugar monitoring, and diet and exercise changes. It's natural to feel anxious if you're managing it all on your own, says Nancy Oliveira, a registered dietitian and manager of the Nutrition and Wellness Service at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. She is also a certified diabetes care and education specialist, a CDCES. So who are some of those essential team members? Your primary care doctor who oversees your care should be the lead member of your team. You'll also need to meet with the following experts as soon as possible. First, a dietitian. A licensed, registered dietitian will determine the right balance of foods to help control your blood sugar, weight, and other health conditions. It's not a one-size-all-fits-all diet. It's very personalized. We tailor a plan to your food likes and dislikes, schedules, exercise level, nutrient needs, and goals. We also provide education about reading food labels and understanding the role of healthy carbohydrates, proteins, and fats, Oliveira says. Also on the team should be an eye doctor. An optometrist or an ophthalmologist can conduct a comprehensive eye exam with dilation to check for diabetes-related eye problems. These include swelling or bleeding in the retina, the tissue in the back of the eye that receives light, or swelling in the central part of the retina, the macula. Both conditions can result from damage to blood vessels caused by high blood sugar levels and can lead to vision loss. Early diagnosis helps preserve vision. Next is an endocrinologist. This doctor specializes in hormone-related diseases. You'll need an appointment soon after a diabetes diagnosis if you have other medical conditions, such as heart disease, that complicate diabetes care. It's also helpful to add an endocrinologist to your team if your diabetes becomes more difficult to control. For example, if you're taking insulin, especially more than one insulin injection a day or more than one type of insulin, says Dr. Lee Sing Chang, an endocrinologist who specializes in diabetes at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Dr. Chang also recommends seeing an endocrinologist if you're taking three or more diabetes medications, if you are interested in an insulin pump, if your doctor is unfamiliar with the use of continuous glucose monitors, or if you develop a diabetes-related condition, such as problems with the heart, eyes, feet, or nerves. You may also want to see a certified diabetes educator. This professional has additional extensive training in diabetes care and has earned certification for it, the CDCES credential. The educator is typically a nurse in your doctor's office, but dietitians, nurse practitioners, and pharmacists can also be diabetes educators. A good CDCES will fill any gaps in your knowledge about diabetes, equip you with skills for diabetes self-management, and boost your confidence in making healthy lifestyle choices that align with your goals and needs, Dr. Chang says. And there are potential additional team members. Depending on your needs, you might add other experts to your team as well. For example, if you need to start exercising, which is crucial to controlling blood sugar and weight, consider working with a physical therapist or a personal trainer who can design a customized plan for your abilities and teach you how to do the exercises. If you're unable to trim your toenails, which can lead to hard-to-heal foot ulcers and infections, you'll need to see a podiatrist regularly or at least go to a reputable nail salon if you don't have other foot problems. If you need assistance with insurance, transportation, care at home, food security, or overwhelming health needs, turn to a social worker on your doctor's team, or, if it's in the budget, an aging life care manager who might charge $75 to $250 an hour depending on where you live. And if you need extra help sticking to treatment plans, consider working with a certified health coach. Prices start about $50 to $100 an hour. A health coach will learn your entire diabetes care plan, Oliveira says, and help you figure out how to make the plan fit into your life and keep you on track for the best result. As we move into fall, it's time to think about those winter viruses that can attack us and to look at what antiviral medications might be helpful. Winter viruses are on the way, and among them are the bugs that cause flu and COVID. Both viruses can be treated with antiviral medications. If you haven't taken antivirals before, you might wonder if it's necessary to take them if you become infected now, especially if you've previously had COVID or flu. The answer depends on the virus and your age, health, and more. The first question is, which bug do you have? It can be tough to distinguish between COVID and flu, which have similar symptoms: sore throat, runny nose, headache, fever, chills, and muscle aches and pain. If the infection progresses, you may develop a cough, shortness of breath, and a persistent high fever, which are warnings to seek immediate medical attention. How can you tell the difference between the two viral infections? You feel worse faster with the flu, like being hit with a ton of bricks, whereas the onset of COVID can be more subtle. You need to get tested to know which virus you have, said Dr. Daniel Koritskis, chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. He says you don't have to go to a medical setting for a flu or COVID test. Home test kits available at drugstores can determine which virus you have. So how can antivirals help? Knowing which type of infection you're dealing with is crucial because the treatments, available by prescription only, work differently. The go-to antiviral for people with flu who are not hospitalized is oseltamivir, known as Tamiflu. It interferes with an enzyme that allows the virus to leave one cell and infect others. The drug is taken twice daily for 5 days and can shorten the duration of symptoms by a day or two. The main side effects are diarrhea and nausea. The antiviral for people with COVID who are not hospitalized is a combination of nirmatrelvir and ritonavir, known as Paxlovid. Nirmatrelvir stops the virus from copying itself and multiplying. Ritonavir makes nirmatrelvir work better. This combination is taken twice daily for 5 days and can keep COVID from leading to hospitalization. It's unclear if the medication makes your symptoms go away faster, Dr. Koretsky says. The main side effects of Paxlovid are a metallic taste in the mouth caused by nirmatrelvir and nausea and diarrhea caused by ritonavir. The best candidates for antivirals. While your healthcare provider must make the call about whether to prescribe an antiviral, Dr. Koretsky says several factors put you at greater risk and should prompt you to ask for help as soon as possible, even if you've had flu or COVID before. What are these factors? Age, being 65 or older, an impaired immune system, or underlying conditions, especially heart or lung disease. All of these automatically make you more vulnerable to the viruses, even if you've been vaccinated. They also note that pregnant women are also at increased risk for severe influenza and COVID and should consider taking an antiviral. But there is a gray area. What if you're healthy, not yet 65, and vaccinated? You need to have an individual discussion with your healthcare provider, Dr. Koretsky says. For example, you have to balance the benefits of therapy with the potential for drug side effects. But they aren't serious side effects. The drugs are safe and can be stopped if you find the side effects too unpleasant. Other considerations include drug costs, which vary by insurance, how quickly you need to get back to work or your activities, the potential for COVID to rebound after taking nirmatrelvir or ritonavir, which is hotly debated, and protecting people around you. Also, Tamiflu can protect people in your household from getting the flu, Dr. Koretsky says. Your window for antiviral to be effective is limited, 4 to 8 hours from the start of flu symptoms and 5 days from the start of COVID symptoms. It's not harmful to take the medications after that window, but they are less likely to work, Dr. Koretsky says. Pay attention to a scratchy throat or a runny nose, and don't wait to figure out what's going on. And one more thought to consider. It's far better to prevent infection than treat it, Dr. Koretsky says. Get vaccinated and take steps to avoid getting sick. Our next article asks, is it safe to get repeated imaging tests? Fractures, infections, tooth decay, heart conditions, cancer, and stroke. These common health problems are often diagnosed with the help of imaging tests that use ionizing radiation, such as X-rays or computed tomography or CT scans. The tests are considered generally safe, but new evidence suggests a concerning trend in their use, particularly with CT scans. We are exposed to natural radiation in our environment every day. In a year's time, the average person is exposed to 3 millisieverts of this background radiation. X-rays, CT, and some other types of scans expose you to additional radiation. For example, a bone density test emits 0.001 millisieverts. A dental X-ray emits 0.005 millisieverts, and a chest X-ray emits 0.1 millisieverts. The amount of radiation is higher with CT, especially if it's done with contrast dye. For example, a chest CT scan without contrast dye emits 4 millisieverts, whereas one with contrast dye emits 6, says Dr. Mark Hammer, a radiologist at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. Abdominal and pelvic CT scans with contrast dye emit up to 16 millisieverts. Radiation from diagnostic tests has the potential to damage tissue in the body, including cell DNA. Rarely that can cause mutations that lead to cancer 10 or 20 years later. The long-term cancer risk from standard X-rays is considered very low. The risk might be higher from CT. For example, a 2009 study estimated that CT use would eventually account for 2% of annual cancer cases in the United States. That number jumped significantly in a study published in the June 2025 issue of JAMA Internal Medicine. Scientists projected that 103,000 future cases of cancer would eventually develop from 93 million CT tests performed in 62 million people, mostly adults, in 2023. From there, researchers estimated that CT-related cancers could one day account for 5% of annual cancer diagnoses in the United States. Note, however, both studies relied on simulations, and most of the information we have about long-term cancer risk from radiation exposure is derived from atomic bomb survivors, not medical imaging. But why the increase? The higher projection of CT-related cancers doesn't relate to the nature of the scan. CT has the same risk we've known about. For example, the new study found an estimated average of 0.25% increase in cancer risk per one scan for a middle-aged adult. But more patients are getting more scans nowadays, and that could lead to additional cancer cases, Dr. Hammer says. Why are people getting more CT scans? Dr. Hammer suggests 2 reasons. One is that people with cancer who need to be monitored with CT are living longer. The other is that an increasing number of CT scans are being ordered in hospital emergency departments. There might be a push to get people through faster. Also, emergency departments have a greater number of non-physician providers who tend to order more imaging compared to doctors, Dr. Hammer says. So what should you do? X-rays and CT scans provide important information needed to guide treatment. They can catch disease early and sometimes save your life. But if a doctor orders a CT scan and you recently had one of the same type, ask what the results of the new one might show, whether they'll affect treatment, what can be done to reduce the radiation dose, and whether an alternative test that doesn't use radiation, such as MRI or ultrasound, can be substituted. Particularly in a hospital emergency department, the doctors may not know about your medical history. The key question is whether CT is truly necessary. If it is, then the benefits will outweigh the tiny risk of cancer, Dr. Hammer says. However, if guidelines suggest no imaging is needed for these symptoms, then the risk probably outweighs the benefit. Finally, let's look at the marijuana link and cardiovascular death. Using marijuana or cannabis daily or occasionally might not seem dangerous, especially now that it's commonly used for medicinal and recreational purposes. but increasing evidence suggests that the drug is bad for your heart and longevity. The latest research, an analysis published online June 17, 2025 by the journal Heart, suggests that cannabis use doubles the risk of dying early from cardiovascular disease. Scientists pooled the data from 24 recent studies from around the world involving about 200 million people ages 19 to 59. Compared with people who didn't use cannabis, people who did had a 29% higher risk for sudden heart attacks or angina, a 20% higher risk for stroke, and twice the risk of premature death from cardiovascular disease. The study didn't address whether greater use of marijuana led to greater risks or whether risks were different depending on whether people smoked, vaped, or ate the substance. Because the study was observational, it doesn't prove conclusively that cannabis causes heart disease, strokes, and early death. But previous evidence has shown that marijuana use can adversely affect your heart rate, heartbeat, and blood pressure. We have time for one other quick article about walking and back pain. Here's a way to help ward off chronic lower back pain. Try adding more minutes of walking to your day, suggests a study published online June 13, 2025 by JAMA Open Network. Researchers evaluated health information for more than 11,000 people, an average age of 55, in Norway, who were wore activity trackers for about a week, and then were followed for an average of 4 years. None of the participants had low back pain at the start of the study. Compared with people who walked less than 78 minutes a day, those who walked more than 100 minutes had a lower, 23% lower risk of developing chronic low back pain. Walking more than 125 minutes per day didn't reduce the risk much further, nor did walking at a fast pace. The study was observational and can't prove conclusively that walking prevented chronic lower back pain. However, it's plausible, since walking is good for your overall health, especially if you can rack up 100 minutes a day of daily walking. Well, that's it for today's episode of Health Issues. Hope you've enjoyed it and will listen next time. I'm Deborah Love, and I'm reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.